Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
If the world was already becoming more fractured, divided, uncertain, and worrisome, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has made that landscape vastly more troubled. Seismic, epoch-changing, chilling, you can choose your adjective. But today we can listen to somebody who has sat at the top table of global military and security issues, both real and strategized, fathoming these complexities. And he is here today in person with me in London. So I'm thrilled and honored to have the former Chief of the Defence Staff, General Sir Nick Carter, as our guest on the Money Maze podcast. Sir Nick Carter, welcome.
Simon, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm going to spare you the embarrassment of saying this, but you were the longest serving military chief since Lord Mountbatten, having spent nearly 8 years in senior leadership, the first four as head of the army, followed by another 3.5 in the top job, chief of defence staff, and only retired in November 2021. To set the scene, I hope that in today's conversation, we will be able to hear your perspectives on the Ukraine situation. And whilst that is centre stage, it's only one part of a brew of wider geopolitical turmoil. So we can move on to events and thoughts in China, the shifting sands of the Middle East, including Turkey and Iran, through to cyber risks, policy priorities, threats to our democracy from within and without, and much more. So many topics. I'm going to have to restrain myself. But first up, I mentioned in our chat a few weeks ago that I interviewed and was accepted with the Royal Green Jackets back in 1982. And if I had joined, which I didn't, as finance won that contest, you would have been my boss. I missed out. But also I noted that both of us failed our Oxbridge exams. So with the starting gun, I'd love to capture a glimpse of how your youth formed the man you became, born in Kenya and joined the army at 18.
Yes, I mean, I don't think I ever really set out to join the army, but my father was very clear and unequivocal when I ploughed Oxbridge, and it was, you're not going to Red Brick University, go and do something constructive. And as good luck would have it, that was the army, because he'd spent half his life in the army. And the Royal Green Jackets, as you say. And then the idea was that I'd come out and get a professional qualification. And indeed, he teed all that up for me as well. But I discovered after 3 years that actually I was really rather enjoying it. So I extended for a bit and then decided to apply for regular commission, which I duly got. And you might say the rest is history. I did vacillate with leaving before I got to the age of 30 and looked at law school and things like that. But the first Gulf War occurred and I had an interesting job. And of course, that encouraged me to stay for a bit longer. It'll be 45 years come retirement this year.
Well, impossible, but how would you condense four decades?
Well, I think the thing that's been most striking probably is how the world has changed during those 45 years. And I've often said that the pace of change is greater than what we saw in the two world wars of the last century combined. And I think if you look at how change has accelerated over the course of the last 45 years, and indeed how it continues to accelerate, I think change is probably the key defining piece of that period. If you think about it, we started when I was serving at the beginning in the Cold War, which was a bipolar world. The Cold War came to an end and we ended up with a unipolar world in which US hegemony was all powerful. And then, of course, as we step through, in parenthesis, war against terror, we've now ended up, as we step out of that, in a sense, in a multipolar world and a world of great competition.
You asked me to call you by your Christian name, but I feel it's a bit like calling my headmaster by his Christian name. But anyway, you have written presciently on this Russian danger, and you actually wrote about Russia being a clear and present danger 3 years ago and advised that Britain should reduce its vulnerabilities. And what was it that you particularly noticed that maybe others either didn't want to or didn't?
I don't want to come across as being particularly prescient. I mean, I think I had the advantage when I was head of the army, of course, of looking for rationales for what the army should look like. And it's very important if you're doing that, when you're thinking about how the army should be structured and how it should be trained, you quite clearly need to look at the threat as broadly as possible. And it certainly seemed to me, if you went back to, let's say, 2007, when President Putin made a fairly big speech at the Munich Security Conference, in which he renounced the whole idea of NATO enlargement and indeed railed against US hegemony and everything associated with that. It seemed to me that from that moment onwards, we then had the Russian invasion of Georgia. And then 6 years later, of course, the invasion of Crimea and then their incursion into Syria, where they still are today. And then 2017, we see them appear in Libya. And of course, their behavior has become ever more assertive. And of course, in 2018, we saw the shocking attempt to assassinate the Skripal family in Salisbury. So I think when you aggregate all of those things up, when I was speaking in January 18, it was just before the Skripal event in March of that year, I think one could see that Russia had remobilized, it was modernizing, it had some really quite interesting weaponry it was beginning to field. And when you combine that with assertive behavior, it did seem to me, and I've used this term repeatedly, that they appeared to be the acute threat. I always describe China as being more of a chronic challenge, but Russia is the acute threat. And that was how I saw it at the time. And that hasn't changed my view.
So we're going to get into the Ukraine situation, but there is an argument that Russia has been invaded four times since the 17th century and it's used the buffer countries around it to protect them. Do you think that the West underestimated how important that is in the Russian psyche?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think if you go back to 2002, there was a conference which Lord Robertson, as the then Secretary General of NATO, chaired in Rome. And he told me the other day that he was standing on a platform with President Berlusconi and President Putin. And President Putin made it very clear that, in his opinion, Russia was always portrayed and always appeared to be on the wrong side of history when it came to his relationship, certainly with Europe and with the West more broadly, and that he, President Putin, wanted to change that because he could see that the future was much more about Russia being part of Europe and being part of the firmament that the Western world represented. And he said that very publicly in 2002. And of course, if you go back and you look at what occurred in 1990, when there was a conversation in a corridor between James Baker and President Gorbachev at the time, who led the Soviet Union then, about German reunification. People have claimed that some deal was made. The answer is no deal was ever made. And of course, if you then go to 1994 and you see the Budapest Declaration, where the Ukrainians agreed to give up their nuclear weapons and that their territorial integrity would be assured by the West and, of course, by Russia as well. I think there's a certain amount of rewriting of history going on here. And perhaps the killer point, I think, is that the reason it's called NATO enlargement rather than NATO expansion is because actually NATO doesn't invite anybody to join it. Countries apply to join NATO. And indeed, in 2010, at the then NATO conference, Ukraine applied to join NATO and NATO refused its membership for all sorts of reasons. So I don't think it is right and proper for President Putin to argue that what is happening in Ukraine now is the fault of NATO and the fault of NATO enlargement. NATO is a defensive alliance and it doesn't invite people to join it. So I think he's attempting to rewrite history. And of course, his propaganda narrative is about trying to find excuses and pretexts for why he is now behaving as he is. And we shouldn't believe any of it.
Very clear. So let's maybe start with the high level question, which is, how do you assess the situation right now?
First and foremost, we need to be clear that however this ends, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure, Putin has already lost. He's lost, first and foremost, because if he tried to impose a puppet regime in Ukraine, it would have absolutely no legitimacy, and certainly not with the Ukrainian people. And indeed, one of the things that he's also managed to do very stupidly is to unite Ukraine around a sense of Ukrainian nationhood, which is probably now more powerful than it's ever been. And that nationhood won't go away anytime soon and will certainly outlive President Putin. Secondly, of course, if he is going to impose a puppet regime on Ukraine, he's going to have to occupy the country. And a country of 41 million people, although people are now clearly leaving for obvious reasons, and a country in geographic terms, the largest country in Europe, he'll probably need 500,000 troops to occupy that country. And it will become a very unpleasant insurgency, guerrilla campaign if he does do that. And it will be very expensive to him in blood and treasure, and something I just simply don't think he'll be able to afford. Third, then, he's managed to unite the international community against him. And he's done that much more successfully than NATO or the European Union have done in their history, probably. That's a very stupid place to be, because in tandem, he's managed to isolate himself from the international community as well. And that's going to be expensive in terms of sport, culture, the economy, and so on and so forth. And it's going to take a very long time for anybody ever to trust him again. So that sense of isolation is probably going to be around for a very, very long time. And then, of course, the question that is very difficult for us as outsiders to answer is that he does appear to have mobilized dissent against his regime inside his own country. How that evolves remains to be seen, and it will be extremely difficult for those who wish to mount a campaign against him to do so because of the repressive measures that his government has now put in place. But there is quite clearly dissent in his country now. So the answer is, whichever way you look at it, he's lost. But that's a dangerous place for him to be, because like the cornered rat that we gather he might have bumped into in St. Petersburg as a young man, rats tend to fight back. And I think that's the thing we all need to be watching very carefully now.
So that really leads into my next question, which is, what do you think is going on in his mind?
I personally don't think that he's mad. I think he's a rational human being. I think that people have often said you just need to listen to what he says and read what he writes to understand where he's coming from. And of course, last summer in July, he wrote that essay on the historic relationship between Russia and Ukraine. And he feels profoundly, I think, that Russia, Ukraine and Belarus are very much three countries that frankly share the same history and legacy and are better off united and together. So he feels very strongly about that. And I think what we're seeing is his sense of passion for that belief. I think what we're also seeing as a man who's been in power now for 22 years, as a result of that, I think he probably feels he's invincible. There's a sense of megalomania, perhaps, in some of his more recent pronouncements and a sort of messianic way of speaking, which is slightly scary. And because of all of that, I don't think that he probably has many people around him who speak truth to power. So I think there's a slight sense of isolation about him. And I'm speculating, but I suspect even those who are brave enough to tell him that he was not going to find his army being welcomed with open arms in Ukraine were believed. So I think that he's believing his own propaganda. And of course, that's a very dangerous place to be, as we have seen over the first week or so of this war, because of course his army has not been greeted as liberators. And the upshot of that is that the whole plan was based upon fundamentally flawed assumptions, and no good ever comes of a military plan that's based on flawed assumptions.
So geopolitical miscalculations are immense. Have there been some military on the ground miscalculations from the get-go about how he expected this war to be executed?
Well, I think he clearly set some political objectives which look like they are completely impossible to be translated into reasonable and sensible military objectives. And we've seen in many cases in history where the political objectives are out of alignment with the military objectives, that will only end badly. And of course, the political objectives, which we assume in maximalist terms are about subjugating Ukraine and putting in a puppet regime, and perhaps in less maximalist terms might be about subsuming the Donbass and maybe the coast of the Sea of Azov to link Russia to Crimea, maybe even seize all of the land to the east of the River Dnieper. I don't know. But these political objectives are probably unrealizable in military terms. So that's the first problem. Then I think it comes back to the assumption that was clearly made that his army would be greeted as liberators. And of course, if you think you're going to be greeted as liberators, and you also keep it very quiet from your army what it might have to do, the psychology, when the leading elements of that army suddenly get a bloody nose, means that it's very difficult to persuade those soldiers to fight in the way that they probably need to fight. And it's been a very rude shock, both in terms of the way they were sustaining themselves with logistics, and we've seen that, the way the planning was conducted, a lot of combat power being passed down single routes. They've been unlucky with the weather. It's very mild. So off-road, it's very muddy and difficult to passage. So for all those sorts of reasons, they haven't had the right force organization. to be able to deal with what has become a fight rather than a liberation. And of course, describing the thing as a special military operation, as he did in his pronouncement the week before last, bottom line is that it's turning out to be a war. And that means that they're going to have to think really hard about how they reorganize their military effort to be able to fight a war. And we're beginning to see what that looks like during the course of this recent week.
I think it was Napoleon who said that the success of any campaign was one quarter attributable to numbers and material and three quarters to morale. And although I think there's been an assumption that many of his troops are battle-hardened because of the Middle East, etc., do you suspect that that isn't the case?
We're hearing, aren't we, lots of reports of young conscripts being completely amazed by what they've found in Ukraine. And as a result, we're hearing about desertions and people voluntarily surrendering and so on and so forth. So yes, I mean, I think the moral component is important in all of this. And we military, when we're trying to measure the fighting effectiveness of armed forces, talk about the components of fighting power. And that's the conceptual at the top of the pyramid and the physical and the moral. And what we're seeing here very clearly is that the moral component is very powerful on the Ukrainian side, most impressively led and marshaled by President Zelensky, who's managed to get this sense of Ukrainian nationhood at the heart of how the fight is being conducted, whether those are regular forces or irregular forces, or even the civilians who are putting their shoulder to the wheel as well, versus a Russian army that already appears to be demoralized, psychologically unprepared for what it's now having to confront, and frankly, questions about its endurance and its ability to be able to continue to fight in the way that it'll be required. And this fight's going to get worse rather than better, I fear, for everybody.
So I'm going to quote you again, escalation can lead to miscalculation. What would you be advising?
Quite clearly, the most fundamental thing we can do at the moment is to really reinforce the unity of our NATO alliance and our broader alliance across the international community. And then fundamentally, we need to try and contain this. We don't want this war to become a regional conflict or, for that matter, a more global conflict. So trying to contain it is fundamental. But that's going to require some really difficult choices because, of course, as we saw during the Bosnian Balkan thing in the 90s, when you start to see some really ugly images emerging from these sorts of conflicts and crises, public opinion has a say in what occurs. And I fear we're going to see some really unpleasant and ugly and terrifying images beginning to emerge. So how you contain all of this is fundamentally where our political leadership, our statesmen and women have got to be on this. There is this extraordinary reawakening that's occurred in the Western world. Extraordinary hearing on the 28th of February, Chancellor Scholz's speech and announcement in Germany that he was going to raise German defence spending to 2% and in a sense focus Germany on the threat in a way that we haven't seen for many, many years. These are really seismic changes in the way the world is now thinking and the way, of course, the world will evolve. So I think we are having this sort of reawakening about what we stand for. And if, going back to why perhaps President Putin has lost, a lot of autocrats across the world will be looking at this with some interest because perhaps the West has realized what the West stands for and we've been woken a bit out of our slumber. And maybe Francis Fukuyama's prediction is going to come true.
What will this do for NATO and its future direction?
Well, I think it's now much more likely that all NATO members will step up to the plate and raise their defence spending to the minimum of 2%, which was what was prescribed back in 2014 at the NATO conference in Cardiff. Whether or not 2% is enough, I think a lot of people are reflecting on, given how the world is going to look, however this thing evolves. So I think obviously we're going to see more defence spending. I think we're also going to see NATO perhaps realising that readiness is going to be important again at a level that we haven't seen probably since the days of the Cold War. And that means that you'll be need to understand how you can mobilize, to understand the sort of war stocks that you need to have readily available to you. We began to learn some big lessons, didn't we, through COVID about supply chains and resilience. So I think one will see a lot of people protecting supply chains and thinking hard about resilience as distinct from efficiency. So I think that'll be an important change. And I guess shares in defense industry are going up as we speak, Simon, in your world. So I think we'll see a bit of that. I suspect we're also going to see probably quite a thought given to what NATO's posture needs to look like in military and political terms in relation to this threat. I mean, are we going to see a new Iron Curtain descending in Europe? Are we going to see the need for people to be forward deployed in order to provide the sort of reassurance to those countries who are nearer Russia and to deter Russia, obviously? It's interesting, isn't it, that two neutral countries in Sweden and Switzerland have stepped up to the plate, in the former to supply arms and in the latter to get behind the remarkable sanctions that have been imposed from the 28th of February onwards. And then I think Finland. I'm told there was a recent poll in Finland where the majority thought that joining NATO might not be such a bad thing to do. So I think you can see that the whole NATO thing is going to be much more on the front burner than perhaps it's been in the past. And if one was thinking about with a NATO, as people were with an H rather than an I, of course, even a year or two ago, and you'll remember that President Macron described it as brain dead before the London conference a couple of years ago. I think the reality now is that it's quite obvious that NATO has got a very, very important role in assuring the stability of the Western world.
So before we leave Russia and Ukraine, is there some compromise that you can envisage?
I can't see anything at the moment. A number of thoughts, really. First, an obvious thought as a soldier is that all wars ultimately end in a conversation, and this will end in a conversation as well. I think we need to recognise that this is not going to be a solution that we impose on Ukraine. The Ukraine has got to be at the front end of this conversation. They are fighting for their country and they're fighting for freedom at the moment. And our hearts go out to them. But ultimately, they need to be the determinants of what any conversation or compromise may lead to. We can only support them in that. I think that there will be some big questions asked about how that is brokered and negotiated. And I personally think that countries like China have got a very important role to play in this. I don't think China likes instability. It very much depends upon a global economy that is essentially stable and which gives them the opportunity to trade. And if they see globalization being knocked in the way that this crisis is obviously doing, that will worry them. So I think they've got a big motivating reason to try and bring the parties to the table and to find a negotiated solution. So it's going to take somebody who I think President Putin respects to try and find a way through this. And I hope that somebody will step up to the plate to bring the parties to the table and get talking as soon as possible. But the trouble with war is you have to probably fight a bit in order to get into a position where the parties are exhausted and are therefore best prepared to have that conversation. And I fear that is going to go on for a bit longer yet.
So you've moved to China, which was my next question. So maybe high level, how do you assess China's geopolitical and military ambitions?
First and foremost, I think China believes, if you go back into several hundred years, that they have a historic right of entitlement to be a great power in this world. And of course, the way that their economic development has gone since they joined the World Trade Organization all those years ago has been only upwards, and it's going to continue to do that. And my judgment is that, of course, as everybody will predict, is that China is going to be an equal great power to the United States within the course of the next decade. I personally think that China wants to do that in a peaceful way. I don't believe that it wants to bring greater instability to the world than what we've seen already. The challenge, of course, is that China has a different system. And I think what we see is a country that espouses a way of life that's less free than the way of life that we espouse. And of course, they are governed by an autocratic regime, which is very different to what we all stand for in the Western or democratic world. So I think that there's going to be this clash of values as China becomes stronger. And it's how you manage that clash, that competition of values, which is challenging. And my own view is that a lot of this is going to manifest itself in the way that China's technology begins to be embraced within the world. And I think that the way we're headed is it'll be very likely that there will be parallel models of technology. I've talked a lot about Belt and Road, but particularly about the digital Silk Road, which I think is of more interest than the Belt and Road Initiative. And I think if you look at some of the evidence, China's global positioning system, Beidou, or Big Dipper as it's known, is now found to be accurate in more capital cities in the world than the US-sponsored GPS, so Asia Today was saying a couple of years ago. And of course, global positioning technology is at the heart of smart cities. And of course, if you go down that direction, that gives China the first step in creating smart cities, which if you then link to 5G technology, where they're quite clearly leading the world, and you bring in some of their surveillance technology, their video recognition technology, and all the other things that go with it, I think you can very easily see how their values could be translated through this technology into those values being imposed on countries in the world, which perhaps we might have thought were oriented traditionally more in our direction. So I think you can see how parallel technological models and values are going to be really at the heart of how this competition evolves. And I personally think it's dangerous to talk about a new Cold War or anything like that. What we need to be talking about is how we create communities of interest of different countries around different interests that ultimately can help steer this thing in a way that is non-confrontational and in which we can learn to live more effectively together.
So I understand that, and whether it's strategic metals needed for the energy transition or whether it's the whole internet and how that plays out, still hanging over the conversation is Taiwan. Has Chinese thinking changed at all in light of what's going on in Ukraine?
Straight answer is I don't know. I mean, I thought it was very interesting that the headline of China Today last Wednesday, so what was that, the 2nd of March, I guess, was invasion. Now, they're using that word in that way, I think, gave an indication of perhaps what China thought about what was happening in Ukraine. But I suspect China is being very thoughtful about the international community's response to what's occurred in Ukraine, because the point I made earlier in our conversation about reawakening and what the West perhaps realizing what it stands for is relevant to how China thinks about what might happen in Taiwan. So I think the sleeping elephant has woken up, and that will be something that I think in political terms causes a lot of people to think about, but China particularly. So I think the Taiwan question, it will have changed thinking in China to one degree or another. And then, of course, there is this question mark about the relationship between China and Russia. What Russia has ended up or will end up doing is becoming dependent upon China as a result of what it has done in Ukraine. And that dependency, that linkage, is going to make, I suspect, Russia very subservient to China. I doubt that China, which has trade of around £950 billion with the rest of the world, and probably only about £80 billion worth of trade with Russia, is it going to really give up the chance of the £950 billion in relation to the £85 billion? I doubt it. So I think China will be quite thoughtful about what it does now. And I don't think we can predict that, because it's clearly in the mind of the leadership. But I do think that this is a seismic shift in the way all of us will think about the world, and China will be thinking hard as well.
So staying with oil and politics, the Middle East is perhaps not in the current conversation, and yet we saw Turkey, interestingly, invoke this convention to block the passage of a Russian naval vessel. There is talk of some rapprochement with Iran. Shifting sands, what's going on?
Absolutely shifting sands. And of course, we're going to need the oil producing countries of the Middle East to step up to the plate, aren't we? Because if the American idea of stopping oil exports from Russia comes to pass, then somebody else is going to have to pick up the burden. And we are already seeing the price per barrel going up well over $100 a barrel. And that's not something that we can sustain at the moment. And the same obviously applies to gas. So I think the commodity crunch is going to drive a slightly different relationship with the Middle East than perhaps we might have had 2 or 3 weeks ago. And of course, there's going to be a broader commodity crunch as well. The Middle East gets a huge amount of its grain from Ukraine. I think Russia and Ukraine produce about a third of the world's grain, and a lot of that goes to the Middle East. And I know from connections in the Middle East that they're worried about what this might mean to food in the Middle East. So I think there are a whole load of possible second and third order consequences as a result of what's going on, which will bear upon this. And there are people who are going to have to make some quite difficult calculations, whether that's Turkey. You mentioned that their right to block warships moving in and out of the Black Sea. And of course, they've always believed in a balance of power in the Black Sea. And if that balance of power shifts very fundamentally towards Russia, with Russia acquiring Odessa and the Sea of Azov, as well as much of the coastline of the Black Sea, then that puts Turkey in a very different position to where perhaps it was 3 or 4 weeks ago. And that will have a bearing upon what Turkey thinks about its strategic posture in relation to NATO, the Middle East more broadly, and of course with Russia. And then I think Iran is going to be a factor in this. How does Iran play into it? And it was interesting, wasn't it, that in week one of the war, ex-president Ahmadinejad tweeted support for the Ukrainian people. Well, what does that mean? Israel, again, having to be quite thoughtful about what might happen. They've very much depended in terms of the ability to be able to get after Iran in Syria with a relationship with Russia. So there are a lot of people having to think very differently in terms of the strategic calculus as a consequence of this. None of it bodes well, I think, for stability. And those calculations will be happening very quickly. And I think we need to be clear that our future will very much depend upon some of the decisions that come to as people think about that strategic calculus in the Middle East.
So let's talk about the changing nature of war. I'm going to quote you again. You said our ability to preempt or respond to threats will be eroded if we don't keep up with our adversaries. The types of tools available to operators has changed. How do you assess this new era of waging war?
So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to be a little bit pedantic. We military people distinguish between the nature of war and the character of warfare or conflict. And the reason we do that is because exponents of that great Prussian master, Clausewitz, will know that the nature of war never changes. It is always a political act. It is always a violent and friction-full clashing of wills. And we are seeing it playing out in Ukraine now, where it is very much a human interaction, which is always violent and it's always full of friction. Think about Russian battalion tactical groups that are trying to move down that single route from Belarus to Kyiv at the moment. They understand what friction is, no question about it. So that's the nature of war. What changes, though, is the character of warfare. And of course, that's where new tools, techniques and tactics evolve as you get into a different sort of conflict. And what we're seeing, I think, fundamentally in this conflict are some things that we've probably known about for a long time. First of all, the power of the narrative. And I often quote a very good book written by somebody called David Patrikarakos, who commented on the first war in the Donbass in 2015, a book called War in 140 Characters. And what he observed is that basically he was witnessing two wars going on. There's the physical war involving tanks, artillery and infantry. And then there's the war in the media domain, and particularly the social media domain. And the interesting thing is that the latter is probably more decisive than the former. And of course, we're seeing that in spades in what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment. You know, the power of the narrative, the battle of the narrative is right at the heart of everything we're seeing. And the reason for that is because of the power of information, the fact that so much of this is played out in a fishbowl. Compare it to the Falklands all those years ago. This is now very much in everybody's minds, and it then plays to public opinion and how public opinion might influence political opinion. So that's a big deal. And then, of course, we're also seeing new weapon systems. We're seeing cyber, clearly. Space is having an impact. We heard about Elon Musk putting satellites over Ukraine to try and keep the internet going. And, of course, missile systems, thermobarics, hypersonics, all these terms that people now probably understand. They wouldn't have done about 3 weeks ago. These change the character of what happens on that battlefield. So weaponry has a big impact upon it. And then, of course, so does human nature and how human nature plays into this. So I think we're seeing a different character of warfare, but sadly we're seeing the nature of war being what it always has been, which is this unpleasant clash of wills, which is a violent interaction between peoples.
When we think about Western security cooperation, how have some of the Western powers been developing their communication and sharing thoughts around cyber intelligence?
The club that you're referring to is something called Five Eyes, which has been an intelligence sharing mechanism between the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And it's been predominantly over the last, I suppose, 40 or 50 years, it's been about intelligence, but it's actually always been a lot of other things as well. And of course, I think with the greater challenge coming from China, and of course, what we see with Russia as we're speaking, I think a realization that this club can be something that can be used for other purposes as well. And of course, that's why this agreement was signed between the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom, called AUKUS, essentially for nuclear submarine technology, because there was a realization, I think, in Australian minds that given the character of likely conflict or competition, if you like, in the Pacific, that nuclear submarines were probably something that they needed. And that's why that agreement was signed. But going back to my point about communities of interest, that is an obvious community of interest, but there will be others as well. And I think that what we're seeing is that countries are making calculations about where their futures lie and who can help them attain those futures. There's another very important agreement that is delivering stability and effect at the moment, and that is called the Quad, where India, Japan, the United States and Australia have come together. And I think these sorts of gatherings of countries with like-minded interests are a way of stabilizing in what is essentially a multipolar world these days. And that's what's playing out, I think, and we'll see that playing out even more.
You stated that in terms of how we respond and the priorities of how we spend money is that more of the same will not be enough. I wonder maybe you can just summarize what the key things you would like to see adopted.
I think it comes back to this point about a reawakening. I think we have been very privileged and very fortunate to have lived in a world which Francis Fukuyama wrote about when he wrote about the end of history, where we didn't foresee war being a thing again. And that means we've been able to have the luxury of investing in things to make ourselves ever more comfortable. And I think that what will happen as a result of what is going on in Ukraine at the moment will be this reawakening, this realization that actually, we have to pay for stability and security in the future. We can't assume it. And that means, I think, that governments will be confronted with choices about where they have to spend money to do their foremost priority for their country, which is about securing their countries. Security spending is going to have to increase, I suspect, to be confident that we're doing that. And I say security spending because it's not just defence spending. It's about domains like cyber. And there'll be things that we have to do in relation to what other countries try to do to undermine our way of life, which require us to defend ourselves and to make sacrifices that perhaps we wouldn't necessarily have thought we'd have to make even 6 months ago. So I think there are going to be compromises and choices which Western governments are going to have to make in order to secure their populations. And that will be painful for people and is going to require quite a lot of tough leadership, I think, to persuade people that this is the right thing to be done.
And one has read from numerous surveys that the youth in many Western countries doesn't appear to have valued democracy as much as previous generations. Is this the needle-moving event?
I hope so. Freedom House would say that the last 5 years have seen more countries revert from democracy towards something more autocratic than at any time in the last 75 years. So yes, I mean, I think democracy is withering without an H. And I think that if we care for democracy, we need to think really hard about what has happened to it over the last 5 to 10 years. It's become increasingly populist, increasingly divided. The middle ground is not nearly as obvious as it once was. And I think that if you go back to Francis Fukuyama and the end of history, his observation was that if democracy was going to fail, it would fail from inside. And I think that's what we have been witnessing slowly over the course of the last 10 years or so. And I think this may provide a moment for us to reflect hard on the middle ground. And I think that in our country, it would be great if the two major political parties could agree that what's needed now is something that perhaps gets after our security in a way that is appropriate for the new security context in which we're going to find ourselves following this invasion of Ukraine.
So many of the Money Makers podcast listeners make weekly investment decisions under pressure and against the backdrop of uncertainty from portfolio managers and asset allocators to CIOs and CEOs. And hindsight will judge them and determine their promotion, compensation, self-worth, etc. What have you learned about decision-making under pressure that applies beyond the military?
I think for all leaders in this world, we talked earlier in this conversation about the pace of change being very fast and, of course, almost exponentially increasing every year. And therefore, I think that for my mind, the most important characteristic of strategic leadership is the ability to listen and to learn. That silly old phrase about every day being a school day is relevant in all of this, because only if you listen and you learn will you be adaptable. And of course, what we military learn, and we're seeing this as this crisis plays out in Ukraine, is that whatever you might have expected that war to look like when it starts, it won't be what you predicted, because you can't predict the future character of warfare, really. And that therefore means that adaptability has to be the key criteria. And that means you have to train people to be adaptable. And I think it also, if you want people to be those who will listen and learn, that requires a bit of humility, because it also requires you to admit that you're wrong. And I think that that's a pretty fundamental characteristic of strategic leadership. I think the other thing about it is, given that the information domain is what it now is, everything plays out now in a fishbowl, I think because of the information domain, you need to recognize that if you want decisions to be realized, you can't necessarily expect it to happen automatically. You have to shape the environment for those decisions to be realized, and the audience needs to be shaped for all of that. So I think for strategic leadership, the sense of shaping is important. And fundamentally, all of it is underpinned by having the best possible quality of advice, insight, and understanding. And every time we've got it wrong on battlefields in my career, it's because we didn't have adequate insight and understanding at the front end of what we were doing. And I think that will be a lesson that I'm sure the Russian General Staff is reflecting on at the moment.
Peter Frankopan, author of The Silk Roads, head of global history at Oxford, who has been on our show, actually in an interchange with him raised the question, and I'm going to quote it. He says, "What are the UK's main advantages in a world that looks a lot more hostile and challenging?"
I think that it's certainly the case in military terms, but I think more broadly in terms of our national psyche is that I think we do produce very innovative people. And I think that innovation in a world where adaptability is going to be a fundamental characteristic is something that we should be doubling down on. And I think the ability to decentralize, to give people their head, to allow that innovation and imagination to flourish is where I think we've got an opportunity to double down. I also think that as a nation, we have a set of values and we have a set of principles and we have a legislative system that we can all be pretty proud of, I think. And I think that makes us into a very secure and stable society. And I think that in a world where it's going to become much more complex and dynamic, where I guess the defining condition is going to be instability, then having that stability in your society is fundamental. And I think that has to be one of our national strengths and is one of the reasons why I think, you know, a lot of foreigners want to come and live in our country. And then I think the other characteristics, which if you push the British public, I think is right at the heart of them, is the generosity of spirit. And I think in this world, generosity of spirit is going to be quite an important ingredient as we look forwards. And I hope that we have that generosity of spirit towards the Ukrainian population over the course of the next few weeks and months.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here. We all have to think about our pensions and our investment decisions, but how are you thinking about where you would deploy your own savings over the coming years?
Well, I'm in the ironic position, of course, of not really having to worry about where my pension comes from because it's given to me by a grateful government and it's generously index linked as well. But if I were in that position, I think energy is a very interesting sector at the moment, how that's going to evolve. Betting on some of that is obviously going to be an important angle to what we do. I think commodities generally, I think that's going to be interesting. I think over the next 5 to 10 years, the defence sector is going to take on more of an important role than perhaps it did in the past. But I also think, as it's always been, I think innovation and technology at the moment has got to be surely at the heart of what we're trying to do, because however unstable this world is and does become still further, it'll be those who've got an edge somewhere, and that edge is going to be found from technology, that'll be at the heart of what they do. And of course, people are at the heart of that. So education is going to be important.
So I've got a few closing questions. You've done a huge job. What's the next challenge?
I think getting some balance in one's life. The last 10 years, I've been very busy. And I think if you do that, your focus inevitably becomes rather a selfish focus on the job and what you're doing. And there are people I care a lot about in my life who I've not invested as much time in as I should have done. Being more present for them, I think, is a really important thing to do. And then I suppose I would like to maintain interest in what I've learned over the last 10 years. And I think if one can pass some of that on to others to help perhaps them create a better world, then surely that's got to be a good thing to do as well. So I suspect a sort of portfolio of things around the notion of strategic advice and strategic thought, if I can do that, would be probably where I would see myself headed.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of organisations that could benefit from your experience and insights. What's your most important daily habit today? And what was it when you were in the army?
I've always made my bed the moment I've got out of it. And I think taking some exercise every day, I think, is important. Having a routine, having a rhythm to what you do is important. I think that it's been interesting for me transitioning from a world where Microsoft Office had scheduled every 30 minutes of your day to a world where you're responsible for scheduling what you want to do. It has been interesting in terms of trying to maintain a routine and a rhythm to your daily life. All of a sudden, weekends take on less relevance, don't they? Which is an extraordinary position to be in. But I think having a routine, having a rhythm, which starts with making your bed when you get out of it in the morning, but then actually also having an open mind and taking a bit of exercise, I think those are the things that matter to me.
As I play this podcast around the house, I'm going to accidentally have a repeat function about making your bed so my 3 children could not avoid hearing it several times. What advice would you give to young men and women thinking about joining the services?
It's not for everybody. What I admire so much about my children's generation is that I think they want to give something back. I think they care very much about the world in a way that I'm not sure our generation did. I think we were more egotistical in terms of what we were after. So I admire that. And I think if you do want to put something back, I think that a career in the armed forces, which has service at the heart of what it does, is a very good career for people, because that sense of service and duty automatically means that you're thinking about others. And therefore, in thinking about others, I think you probably will make the world a better place. So I would thoroughly recommend it for those who want to add value in the world.
There's this great book that we've quoted, so I'm going to ask you the question that they pose, which is, if you could tell us just one thing.
Always try and see things from the other person's perspective.
Very good advice. And in terms of managing people, what characteristics, and I use that word rather than qualities, do you think make the best leaders?
If I may be pedantic again, I think I wouldn't use the word managing. I would try and use the word leading, because I think, as you'd know, the motto of Sandhurst, where army officers are trained, is serve to lead. And I think that that mantra, serve to lead, is at the heart of the way that you should lead the people who work for you. And that means that you need to know them, you need to understand them, and you need to care for them. And I think if you can do that, then they will want to work for you, and you will end up with a much more productive organization than you would do otherwise.
Yeah, that's very well said. My three final questions. Given the choice of anyone in the world, who would you want to have as a dinner guest?
Can it be somebody who's no longer with us?
Yes.
Nelson Mandela.
Right. And interestingly, you aren't the first person who's wanted that. She goes to say what a powerful individual he was. What would constitute today a perfect day?
A subpar round of golf around a great golf course.
Well, between Will Campin and myself, I think we might be able to arrange an option or two. And finally, what are you most grateful for?
The support I've had a lot of my life from my wife and my children.
Well, Nick, we could go on, but I have taken so much from this, and we'll put some of it into the show notes. So excited about this release. Of the two principal conclusions I'm going to take away, apart from the recommendation to read a book which is called War in 140 Characters, is that number one, I thought you gave a very balanced assessment of China and its position and how significant a role it can play, and that great advice, which is listen, learn, and adapt. And I'm not too old to benefit from that. So General Sir Nick Carter, thank you so much for being here today. And a thank you also to our mutual friend, Johnny Gray, who made this interview possible. And we very much hope to have you back on the Many Maids podcast in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maids podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.